Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, February 21st, 2011. Members, we have a full agenda here today. Each group has been asked for a brief 15-minute presentation, which I'm sure is packed with information. So I ask you to please listen carefully so we can move forward with this. The first item on the agenda is the presentation from the Minnesota Investment Board. So if we could have Howard Bicker and Jim Heidelberg come forward. I see there's one of you.
Jim's
here. Okay. So go ahead and state your name and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the director of the State Investment Board. I was very fortunate my wife decided she couldn't make it to work because if I didn't have her four-wheel vehicle, I wouldn't be still trying to figure out how to get here. We prepared a quick overview of the State Board of Investment for you all. Are you doing this or am I doing this? I'm doing that? How do I do it?
There you go.
Okay. The members of the board, there are four members of the State Board of Investment. They are the governor, the state auditor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. And that is by the Constitution. The board has an investment advisory council that advises the board and staff on various investment policy issues. 10 of the members are from the local investment community, the people from like 3M and Target and Cargill. The Commissioner of Finance, and we keep doing that, just old, I can't change. It's the Commissioner of, what is it, MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm still used to saying finance. The directors of the three retirement systems serve on the advisory council, two active employees and one retiree appointed by the governor. And I have a staff of 21 that's responsible for the ongoing day-to-day investments. The next is an executive summary of the assets under management by the State Board of Investment. This is as of the end of the fiscal year, as of June 30th. The total is $52.5 billion. You can see the majority of it is what we call the combined funds, which is the fund for the big statewide retirement funds. We invest the Supplemental Investment Fund, which is basically, for lack of a better word, some mutual funds that are available to volunteer fire relief associations, unclassified employees. We also run the state's deferred compensation plan from an investment perspective. The state retirement system administers this plan. And we also run a lot of non-retirement related assets. We do the assigned risk plan, which is part of the state's workers' comp system. We do the permanent school fund. The Environmental Trust Fund, which is the proceeds or a portion of the proceeds from the state lottery, and then the state's cash accounts, and then we have a number of miscellaneous accounts. Next is a quick review of the results of our investment program. We have basically two long-term objectives. One is over 20 years to provide a real rate of return, and the other is to beat market indices. You can see that the first, which is our total rate of return versus inflation, we have exceeded inflation over 1, 5, 10, and 20-year time periods. The next is the investment of the retirement-related assets. Last year was a good year. Obviously, most of you remember the previous year was when the market declined. It wasn't good. But you can see that over all periods of time that the board has added value to composite index, and that's the return of the market without being managed. You can see over long, long periods of time, we've, over 20 and 25 years, we have compounded at 9%. And since 1-1 of 1980, which is where we back to where we have clean data, which is over 30 years, we've compounded at 9.7%. As far as our budget, we request an annual appropriation, and the request was $146,000. This is basically to manage the state's general revenue funds. We charge the state for the management of state monies. the retirement systems and other organizations are billed back for their services, so they are not a general fund appropriation. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that is a very quick review. I know you had a full agenda of the State Investment Board, and I'd gladly stand for any questions.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering if I try to compare the size of the agency and your portfolio of $52 billion compared to other organizations, firms that do similar work. How do we compare in terms of, we have 3.2 million in terms of administration and an investment of $52 billion. How does that compare in the market to administrative cost of our management?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres Ray, let's just use a mutual fund, for example. A lot of people would utilize mutual funds for their individual retirement. Mutual funds, on average, would charge you somewhere around 1%. Under $52 billion under management, that means our budget would be $500 million. So as far as a fee for services, we are, let's say, very cost-effective.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. What's that? No. Mr. Becker, could you come? I didn't see Senator Daley did have a question. Sorry about that.
It's all right. Mr. Bisker, thank you, Mr. Chair. The expected rate of return for our pensions is 8.5%. I've talked to several folks that are looking at best practices for other states throughout the country, and it's less than that. It's in ballpark of 7.75%. And what they told me is that in 1989, it was moved from 8% to 8.5% because the market was doing so well. As I look at your chart, it looks like in the last 5 and 10 years, we're below 4% in the last 5-year and 10-year rates of return. Can you just comment on that 8.5%? Do you think that's an artificially high number? Do you think it's a good number? It's a number that we should keep, or do you think we should consider changing it?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Daley, the discussion over 8.5 or 8 or whatever number is discussed, I think should be reviewed on a very, very long-term basis. I personally believe a lot of people are becoming very short-term oriented when you're looking at a retirement plan. Our retirement plans, you know, somebody starts in state service, they're 25, they may retire when they're 65, and they'll live to 85. I mean, that's 60 years that they'll be in the plan. I think we, you know, you are absolutely correct. Over, you know, the last 10-year period, we've had two shocks to the system. We had the recession of a year and a half, 2 years ago, and we also had the terrorist attacks and some corporate shenanigans and so on and so forth in the early 2000, 2001 in the dot-com bubble. Even given those, over the last 30 years, we've compounded at 9.7. which is significantly above the 8.5. Now, I personally believe it would be very nice to reduce to 8.5. Hey, it makes my job easier. And I think it probably would be a good idea to take that into consideration when these plans become a little better funded. Instead of better increases, let's maybe reduce the assumed rate. That is a potential option to look at. I personally don't believe 8.5 is an insurmountable number. Last year we did 15.2. Knock on wood, we're above that so far for this fiscal year. And we are making, hopefully, some significant strides to add to the funded status of our retirement plans. But you are absolutely correct. The 8.5 that we have is on definitely on the higher side of other public entities. There has been a move in certain states and certain municipalities to reduce that. But I don't see the crying need to do it immediately. It's ironic. I mean, you sit here, if we were sitting here in 1998 and somebody asked you what the assumed rate was, they would say, hey, 10's easy. I mean, heck, you've been making 15 or 20 a year. And if we were just sitting here in 2003, they'd say, well, heck, you can't make 2. And then if we were to wait to 2006, we can do 10 again. And then a year and a half ago, you can't make 0. And then last year we made 15.2. This year we're already above 15.2, assuming the market. That's why I like to sit back, and again, my suggestion for whatever it's worth would be that just look at this over very, very long periods of time. If you get very short-term oriented with this, you can really move that number around. You move the funded status around. You can move around employee and employer costs significantly over very short periods of time. And I really don't think if you run a defined benefit plan and you run it over a 30 or 40-year time horizon, that is probably counterproductive in the long run.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. So I just want to make sure I get this right. It's a defined benefit plan. So we are paying 8.5% in our calculations for what they are going to get paid out. That's the number we're using to calculate their benefits.
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, what the 8.5 does is assumes what we will be making on the money over long periods of time. And when you do that, it de facto sets your contribution rates.
Right.
In other words, how much money needs to be paid into the plan. It isn't the payout factor. It's more the pay-in factor so that you have sufficient assets to pay out the pensions in 30 or 40 years.
So follow up.
Senator
Mr. Chair, so based on, so we're giving them the numbers on the payout based on 8.5%. Is that correct?
Mr. Bricker.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, that is correct for the initially promised benefit. There used to be a formula that provided for significant benefit increases to retirees based upon investment performance. That has all been abolished. And now, going forward, benefit increases for retirees are stipulated in statute and in many plans eliminated or reduced based on last year's legislative session.
Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that we are not a portion of our retirement benefits for state employees is presently unfunded. Is that correct?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, that's correct.
So one last thing. My comment is I thank you, Senator Daley, for bringing that up. If we're unfunded, we certainly should be thinking about lowering that a little bit just to make sure we fulfill our obligations.
Mr. Becker.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator, first of all, I'll respond to your question, but really the investment board is the investment side. You can talk to the state retirement, TRA, and MSRS. They know more about that than I do. The reality is, though, if let's say you go from 8.5 to 7.5, pick a number. Now the actuaries have to redo the math and determine what the contribution rates are to support that pension. If you're assuming 7.5 versus 8.5, just as an example, that means you must put a lot more money into the plan. And therefore, employees and employers, historically, Minnesota has been pretty much of a match, 50-50 kind of deal. It would be a significant potential outflow from employers and from employees. And the question is, do you really need to go to 7.5 now? If we continue to have relatively strong markets, the unfunded status of these plans hopefully will go away. I think the key deal is once we get funded, what do we do? Do we give benefit increases? Do we reduce contribution rates? Do we build a surplus? It would be very nice to have a surplus in these plans in the years when we do go down. An 8.5% assumed rate of return, when you build a pension plan around it, an 8.5% assumed rate of return, your standard deviation's around 9. So in other words, two-thirds of the time you're expecting to make 0 or 15 or 16. So when you make 0, everybody goes, holy mackerel, the world's ending. Well, that's expected. That's part of the program. And we need to have sufficient assets in a plan to take care of the liabilities. We're very happy when the standard deviation's on the positive side. We get very panicky when the standard deviation's on the negative side.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ricker, so what are the unfunded liabilities presently?
Mr. Plans?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, again, you have to talk to retirement systems. I don't know the exact numbers.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Daley?
If I could, it's about $15 billion in unfunded liabilities. And if you were to, I talked to the pension board, if you were to reduce that 8.5% to 8% assumed rate of return, that unfunded liability would go up approximately $4 billion with a 0.5% reduction in the assumed rate of return, just to give you a feel for how those numbers work.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Isn't it true that when we have these targets, this targeted rate of return in a defined benefit plan, that essentially the risk of not making that return gets shifted away from the employee into the taxpayer ultimately if we're going to make up that difference?
Mr. Becker.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I guess that's true, but also if you have an assumed rate of return that's appropriate, you're also shifting current burdens away from employees and from the taxpayers on current contribution rates. So there's the trade-off of what's the appropriate number over a long period of time for both employee cost and employer cost. And the idea is to try to have that stable over long periods of time so that funding is simpler and less dramatic, so to speak.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, last couple of questions lead me to believe that we're trying to go someplace where this question doesn't actually lead us. I think, to Senator Daley's point, the assumed rate of return is not a guaranteed rate of return. It's a target. I think what it does more than anything is it gives the investment folks guidance about what level of risk to entertain in the portfolio of investments. And to Mr. Bicker's comments, it really has to do with, you know, our unfunded liabilities and how those came about. And, you know, and we see how the return has been over the last couple of years, 4% and the like, but now we're at 15% on target for 17% this year. So need to take a long-term view. We can have a discussion about what the appropriate rate of return that we want the investment folks to shoot for, and that gives them guidance about, you know, what level of risk and what the mix of risk is, and index funds and stock funds and bond funds, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that folks should be aware of is we've done a lot in the last few years asking retirees to take some consideration in terms of their benefits, asking current active employees to pay more, and putting in a little bit more as a match for employers. And we've made some significant progress. So we're not discovering these liabilities all of a sudden today and, you know, deciding to do something about it. There's been some hard work done in the last few years to try to address the liabilities issues. It's a separate conversation from the assumed rate of return. It does not dictate the payout, and it doesn't shift the burden away from the employees to the employer/taxpayers. It's simply a policy, kind of a target. It's aggressive. It's been met in the past. Maybe it can be met in the future, maybe not. That's a valid conversation, examination to have. But if we're trying to, like, get to a place where this question can't get us, then, you know, I think we need to take a look at that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Second item on the agenda is a presentation from Humanities Center, Mr. O'Fallon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David O'Fallon. I'm the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and I took the job in November. So if you ask me really tough questions that I can't answer, I'll get back to you with a lot more detail than I'll share with you today. Mr. Chair, with your permission, if I could be personal for just a minute or two. In spite of my youthful appearance, I did not take this job as a career move. I took this job for the same reason I'm sure many of you have served the state for a long time, to see if we can't make Minnesota a stronger, healthier place. And that's the spirit I bring this to. I grew up in a little town 70 miles west of here, Litchfield. My dad was a small businessman. And I try to take that same spirit of independence and responsibility, if you will, to this work as well. One of the things that brought me to the Humanities Center was its mission, and I took your letter, Mr. Chairman, very seriously. You asked, what is the mission of the organization? And in broad terms, you know, build a thoughtful and literate and engaged society. And again, on a somewhat more personal level, I have a deep faith, if you will, that beneath all the kind of almost angry voices in our culture right now, there's a common ground that we hold. We all want our kids to be well-educated. We want a society that works well together. We want a healthy economy. That's the work, I think, of this center in the long term. A couple other factors, I think, help shape it. We have responsibility. We don't have any authority. We provide opportunity. We don't provide obligations to anybody. So no one has to work with this center. You only work with it if you find something valuable in what it does. And you can see on the screen up here that in the last couple of years, 80,000 people in over 200 different communities chose to work with the center. They found something valuable in the programs and the work that it's doing. Another piece of this that I personally like a lot is we have to be innovative and entrepreneurial, again, because no one needs to work with us, and we have to add value to whatever community or school that we work with. On the second page, and I think that's this, we actually run a facility. That is the old Gillette Children's Hospital, which was remodeled, so we run a conference center. It sort of breaks even in terms of earning money, but it provides services well over 400 clients, many nonprofits, and used it in the last year. This is a big sketch of the general appropriation that we get from the state and through your committee. It's $500,000, $250,000 a year. And you see that little sidebar over there, and I really do see this as the seed corn. This is the money that keeps that center open and keeps core staff involved. And it allows us, frankly, to leverage lots of private funding. We compete with corporations. We go to foundations. We seek federal funding when that is appropriate. And that allows us to do, you'll see the big three boxes, if you will, under the general appropriation there. We are innovative about education. We've dedicated a lot of funding specifically to help address the achievement gap. And I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. We do a lot of what I call community-based programs. And for me, the headline there is the Great American Story. How did we build this great nation? Where did we come from? How do we get along with each other as the many peoples that we are and the new people coming in? How do we connect? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's a lot of things in our culture right now that are tearing us apart and pulling us away from each other. And I'd like the center to be looking for those places where we connect with each other, the sinews of our strength. There's a great common story, and we're helping people find it. Again, no community needs to work with us, so we work with the communities literally from Elbert Lee through Dassel and through Wilmer and up to Bemidji and Thief River and so on on the stories that they need to tell about their history, their community, things that strengthen them and make them stronger. And then we run the conference center, which I just mentioned briefly. I know that this committee does not have specific authority over the legacy funding, but I wanted to show you that picture. I was given some good advice by the committee staff, Mr. Nessie and Ms. DeBeck. So that big picture is in there for you to look at, and I'm happy to answer questions about that. A big factor, though, that the legacy funding has encouraged and, in fact, told the center to do is that you will work with the four councils of color that the state created some time ago. And we do, and that's been a really good and still evolving partnership. Those councils represent over 700,000 citizens of Minnesota, so learning to work with the multiple histories and concerns. So this happened before I got there, but I've met with all the councils, of course. It happened in the last legislative session. And I met with the councils and talked with them about their priorities. And their priorities are very simple. The number one, the education of our kids. They're not succeeding at the level they need to succeed at. And secondly, stronger communities create stronger education. That's the foundation for real jobs and a strong economy. So I want to direct special attention now to where we're putting a lot of our time and energy and resources. You'll see a page. That's the legacy amendment. I talked briefly about that. Here's the page, partnering to close the achievement gap. This is bringing information and intense professional development to bear on the achievement gap. And again, no one has to work with us. We need to be entrepreneurial and innovative and add value, or people just won't work with us. But the fact is, dozens of schools, hundreds of teachers are choosing to work with us. And I'll draw your attention to that little chart down at the bottom. You'll see a couple of graphs there. This is research-based finding that the way we're addressing the achievement gap has a significant result. The first couple of years, that's really just laying the ground. It was getting started. This was very early in the stages of this project, if you will. But with the addition of new content, getting better at innovative professional development, I'd like you to notice the trend line in what we're calling the case study school, which is a real school. The kids in that school have all the profiles that you would say indicate failure. Poverty rates, stressed out families, economic negative indicators, let me put it that way. Yet I want you to look at especially the trend of the last couple of years against the broad scope of trends in the Minneapolis School District. I think we're on to something, members. I think it's worth the investment, and I think we're only going to get better at it if we can possibly continue it in the years to come.
Senator Olson.
Chairman, Dr. Fallon, I don't want to nitpick, but if you edit this page at all, you might want to, in that paragraph to the next to your case study, change the word statically to statistically.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I accept that edit, and I'm embarrassed that it showed up in here. Forgive me for that one.
You don't need to be embarrassed. It happens, and even spell check wouldn't catch that.
And I thought I read this, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, before I came in the door, but I accept that. So that's statistically significant, Mr. Chairman and members, as you know.
But Mr. Chairman and Dr. Olson. Fallon, I appreciate your focus on this effort, because I think this has to be a concerted effort by all to not only narrow but eliminate the achievement gap.
We need to narrow.
It can be done.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, as Senator Olson knows perhaps, and many other of the senators around the table know, I've got a long history in education and education reform. This is one of the best, most effective projects I've seen in some time. It's one of the reasons I thought I could join this center and see if I couldn't add value and be helpful to them as they make this project particularly effective and stronger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Senator Gazelka. Thank you. Mr. O'Fallon, I just have a question. What is there specific things that you're doing in the case study school to give that significant a difference of proficiency? And is that something that we could get out to the rest of the schools sooner? Or, I mean, that's a pretty significant difference there on your chart.
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, yes, this is a very specific approach. It involves creating new content, but the tough part and, frankly, the time-consuming part is the intense professional development time with the teachers on site and with us in the school. And I could go on way too long about this, I'm sure, but what happens in, you know, we're living in a global world and kids are now coming to Minnesota from all over the place and lots of different issues and so forth and so on. What is helpful here is that the new content and the new practices help teachers engage kids at a level that they were not able to before. Kids genuinely do want to succeed. They want to perform. They want to do well. And this is a pathway to helping them do that. I don't want to digress, and I'm conscious of your time. I've been involved in some huge national top-down reform projects. One of the strengths of this, I think, it's driven by the teachers in that school. It's sort of a bottom-up reform effort. I think that's going to make it sustainable and long-term, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's effective.
Proceed.
The next page gives you a map that shows some of the sites that we're currently involved in and or developing, and I want this to be just a quick illustration of the fact that we're a statewide resource. And then I want to focus on the broader community impact. This is where we're bringing literally into communities the information and the stories that they request. Some of this comes directly to us from the Smithsonian. A couple of recent examples, we worked with a range of communities across the Iron Range to document and tell the story of how the iron ore from Minnesota basically built the tanks, the guns, the ammo of World War II. We were the armory, if you will, of that war. And it was a very important development, and it's amazing. That seems to me obvious, but there's still history that people don't know.
Yep, it's excellent.
It was a great American story.
Yep. Mr. Senator Chairman, you hosted a preview at the Humanity Center, and so I've had a chance to view it. It's excellent, an excellent teaching device as well. Good for all of us to see.
Mr. Chair and Senator, thank you very much. And again, it's a great example of a great American story in the history that we need to know. You'll see down the right-hand side of that page the partners that we work with. I'll refer you back again. That $500K in seed corn money generates enough of a base that we then can go out to multiple other partners and ask them to participate, fund, contribute to, and help extend the projects that we're working on. So again, that's sort of the seed corner launch pad, if you will, funding that gets us into these many multiple partners. And you'll see some quotes in there, which I won't read, from people across the state who've used this. So we use that to bring in, can be exhibits from the Smithsonian, it can be something locally developed. And the point again is to work with the community on what they value, on history that they find compelling and concerning. We don't have a platform. We're not trying to sell anybody anything. And again, that's an example of projects over the last couple of years, communities that we've worked in, spent time in. None of these are dots where somebody drove to town and gave one talk to the Rotary Club and we put a dot there. These are significant long-term projects, teamwork. Mr. Chair, I'll pause there. That's our big overview, and I'm happy to go into questions or detail for any members.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to ask you this. It says in here that the legacy amendment appropriations was $2.1 million, and the general fund is $500,000. Mm-hmm. How much are you looking for in the legacy fund this biennium, and how did you fund your group before the legacy amendment money was coming in?
Mm-hmm. Mr. O'Fallon.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, given the new nature of our times, we're hoping to simply retain the amount of legacy funding at the same level, if at all possible. So I'm not looking for more, obviously. And I'm hoping, if possible, to retain the state appropriation of 500K, if possible.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
To follow up to that, so you're saying you're going to ask for another $2.1 million from the legacy amendment money, and is that going to be then an ongoing thing in order to support this group? I guess, you know, I'm not totally clear on what the legacy amendment funds, how they're distributed, but I'm wondering if it's consistently going to be money that's going to the exact same funding requests. And so maybe you can help me out with that.
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, if I'll flip back to that chart, and I'm prepared to go into a lot of detail on the legacy funding, but let me just, if you look at that, let's go back here for just a moment. You notice on that chart, I think there's a couple of important points on here. One is we were told by legislation you will work with the councils of color, and that money's passing through us to those councils. The Humanities Center, I believe, was asked and then told to do this as a way to sort of represent a kind of cohesive force and to hold a certain single unity accountable for some of the programs. But the fact is the money passes through us, and we sit down with the councils and help them devise projects and programs. You'll see on the right-hand column on that page, that money just literally passes through us. We were told you will pass that money on to the following organizations. So I'm not here to make a funding request today to continue to support projects that we were told we must do in the past. I am here to say that working with the councils of color has been, in fact, a benefit, I believe, to the state, and it's actually been a benefit to closing the achievement gap because we've been led to content, history, projects, and people that by ourselves we probably would not have been able to do.
Senator Goodwin.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, to dominate here, but I have, I'm still not understanding. First of all, I asked if you were going for, yes or no, the same amount for the legacy amendment for the upcoming biennium and how you funded yourselves. Well, I guess what you came into being, how you funded yourselves before legacy amendment money.
Mm-hmm. Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I did say we would love to be able to continue the legacy request at the same amount of money. So that was one answer. And the way the Senate, the center was funded in the past has varied enormously. It did get some National Endowment for the Humanities funding, which is probably in jeopardy, but maybe some portion of that will continue. And frankly, we've been pretty good at raising funds from other corporations, foundations, and individual giving in the past.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next item on the agenda is a presentation from Minnesota Public Radio. We only ate into 8 minutes of your time. I'm just please state your name and you want to help her?
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Lisa Radzak with Minnesota Public Radio. If you can't hear me, let me know. I'll just wait till the PowerPoint gets queued up here. Again, I'm happy to be here. Like I said, my name is Lisa Radzak with Minnesota Public Radio. I wanted to provide you an overview. Hopefully, when we're done, you'll have questions answered about what we do with general fund dollars. Our mission at Minnesota Public Radio is to enrich the mind and nourish the spirit, thereby assisting our audiences to enhance their lives, expand perspectives, and strengthen our communities. At Minnesota Public Radio, we are a driven, dedicated organization that is focused on this mission, and we are absolutely committed to ensuring that all Minnesotans have access to news, cultural programming, and other services that are not available otherwise. This slide, I included it in here as a snapshot. Our organization was founded in 1967 in Collegeville, Minnesota. And I think this captures just a little bit of the evolutions in the rich history that we have. And we're proud that that is under the banner of Minnesota Public Radio. until I think I started at Minnesota Public Radio about a year and a half ago, I hadn't realized nationally and internationally we are a model for public radio and public broadcasting. We offer three services under the banner of Minnesota Public Radio: our news service, classical Minnesota Public Radio, and the current. This map shows the reach that our services, where our services are available across the state. The current is our alternative, for those of you that haven't heard of it or don't listen to it when you're in St. Paul, at least, is our alternative music station that focuses on local music, local artists, and for some of the bands and artists that otherwise maybe wouldn't be, wouldn't have a chance to be on the air, if you will. Our state of Minnesota grants have been used only for the equipment that allows these stations to be available for communities in greater Minnesota. With a sparse population in a lot of these areas, fundraising or capital campaigns targeted just for having the equipment that we need for these stations would not be possible. So, but for the general fund monies that you all have entrusted to us over the years, these stations have been possible for all these communities. We have on our webpage, and there's a classical website, a current website, and the news website, we have almost 900,000 visits every month, and it's growing all the time as our society becomes more and more connected to the internet. Our news service has the region's largest broadcast news staff with over 70 journalists, producers, editors, and hosts. We've won more than 875 journalism awards. We present timely, accurate news and information. We pursue our mission by seeking to build an informed citizenry, and we use objective, fact-based approach in our news gathering. Classical Minnesota Public Radio. We are the largest producer of classical music in the nation. We have 29 regional stations that have that make classical Minnesota Public Radio available across the state. We enjoy our partnerships with the Minnesota Orchestra, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and the Minnesota Opera. One thing I just learned recently that perhaps you all are aware is the I've known growing up about the rich choral tradition we have in Minnesota, and I've always noticed in our churches we are not lacking for people to sing in the church choirs. I didn't realize that that was unique to Minnesota. Some of our classical staff just shared that with me, that people that aren't from here are surprised by that. So sometimes I think that's interesting that some of our ancestors brought that tradition here, and it's a pretty big deal nationwide. We kind of stand out for our choral traditions. Just some fun facts for you. The current is about 6 years old. And let's see here, excuse me. As I said earlier, our focus, the current's focus is on the local and on the music that would otherwise not have a stage. We have community events. The current hosts community events. Yesterday they had Rock the Cradle for families to bring their children to come and learn some new things about instruments and learn some things about music. It's a neat event. And I'm sure you guys have heard of, or maybe you've heard of Rock the Garden in the summer is also, it's both a family and a later event that runs all day in collaboration with the Walker. NPR is the backbone to Minnesota's emergency alert system and the Amber Alert system. We are uniquely situated, being available to 95% of Minnesotans, our broadcast signal. So we have served as the backbone to the emergency alert, Amber Alert system because of that reach. And in the event of an Amber or child abduction alert, a national emergency announcement, a nuclear emergency, chemical emergency, or governor declared emergency, the message is able to get out to the communities across the state quickly. Which brings me to our Minnesota Public Radio's 12-13 general fund request of $460,000 for fiscal year 12 and 13. This request can be broken down into two areas. The first is the FCC is mandating that all states upgrade their emergency alert and amber alert systems. The cost we're estimating will be about $154,000 to upgrade all of our stations with new encoder and decoder boxes to allow for us to receive and send the signals that are needed. And we are also requesting $306,000 for replacing and repairing stations in Greater Minnesota. A teeny bit about the FCC's mandate for the EAS upgrade. What's going to happen now is that some of this is still unsure. What is sure is that it's going to be the deadline for compliance is September 30th of this year, and the equipment upgrades will mean that, one, instead of today right now, it's sort of statewide or nothing for these announcements or alerts. It's going to be, for the first time ever, believe it or not, connected to internet service, which means more local access to the signals will be available. So folks in specific communities now will be able to sort of filter out the signal and only pick up or redistribute the ones that are accessible or applicable to their communities. And also the scope of who all will receive the signal will be expanded. Right now it's just broadcasters, radio, TV, cable statewide. That's going to grow, and it will be things like cell phone providers, internet service providers, hospitals, nursing homes, schools, these types of things. Our infrastructure requests of $306,000 gave you some examples here of the areas that have some needs with the equipment. Some of these stations, a lot of these stations are more than 40 years old, and you can imagine as things have changed, we've been adapting and replacing things and swapping things out as needed, but some of the things are beyond sort of the state of repair or being able to be swapped out. And so that's why we're respectfully requesting $306,000 for some of the equipment needs. And with that, I stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I don't here is the breakdown of what the costs are for MPR and MPTA, where you get the money from currently, kind of a breakdown of how much of it comes from fundraising, how much of it comes from state and federal governments and so forth. Do you have something like that?
Yes, and I could. I don't have it with me, Senator Goodwin. I don't have a handout with me here today. I can tell you, maybe this wouldn't answer your question, but 2% of our funding, less than 2% of our funding is from state dollars, and less than 6% of our funding is from federal dollars. And the largest bulk of our budget is from membership dollars. Secondly, it's underwriting, and then foundations and other grants that we receive, but I can get you a specific breakdown of the numbers.
Ms. Radzak, if you'd get that to my LA, she'll make sure we have copies sent out.
Mr. Chair.
Happy to.
And if you can provide it electronically, that would be better. Don't waste the paper.
Sure, you bet.
Thank you. Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Do you, I thought I heard a few years ago that you guys had some money in reserve. Do you have, I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just asking that. As far as your overall budget, have you built up any reserves for rainy days? And I just wonder where you're at.
Ms. Radzak.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I know that I'm not sure if you're asking about generally or with state dollars. I know that we have no state dollars that are in reserve. And so that's sort of the area that I'm most familiar with. But I can find out if you have other questions about different areas. I would be happy to get you an answer.
Senator Gazelle.
Mr. Chair, yeah, generally I'd like to know that be shared with our committee.
You bet.
Thank you.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. I've noticed with the MPTA that you're doing an awful lot more advertising than you ever did before, and I know they're short spots, but you do a lot of them together before programs and sometimes during. That must bring a lot of additional funding to MPTA. Can you...
can you tell me why you've gone from stations that really did almost no advertising, just sometimes naming the funding, a number of funding sources, to more of an advertising format?
Ms. Radzak.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I'm assuming you're referring to the underwriting spots on NPR's air. Is that what you're asking me about?
Senator Goodwin. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. You do not only mention the companies that were the funding sources, but there's usually a tagline or something that talks about provides these wonderful things or whatever. So it sounds more like advertising than anything, and that's been going on a while, but than anything that you used to do in the past.
Sure.
Who made that decision, and how does that play into your fundraising ability?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I know that the FCC has very strict limitations on what we are and are not allowed to say in our fundraising spots or our underwriting spots. And so I'm going to be sure to look into if that's changed over the years, but I know that there's a very tight limit on what is and is not allowed. So I can perhaps show you if there's a timeline for things have changed in your observation. Obviously they have, so I can find out why that is.
Oh, thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, to that point, could you share with us what those requirements are at the federal level?
Right,
I don't think most of us have that stored in our brains.
Ms. Radzak.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, obviously I don't either, so yes, I'd be happy to look into that and get you the answers.
Thank you.
Thank
One more.
What? Are you
sorry,
sure?
Mr.
One
Chair.
More. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, thank you for being here today. My question, I guess I'm feeding off a little bit of what Senator Goodwin is asking, and I don't know exactly how to ask this. What benefit is the state getting from the sponsorship of Minnesota Public Radio? And it seems to me that Minnesota Public Radio at one time was a true public radio station and now is endeavoring more and more into a commercial, competitive environment with other radio stations. So is it truly still independent, or is it a commercial venture? And also from a standpoint of content, I'm in the media business, and you know, I don't want to get into a full conversation about media bias, but there are lots of different ways that we can have bias in radio and in media. One of them is by how we cover the news that is there, but also there's a choice of what we choose to cover. And it seems that NPR, to many people, is not as independent-minded as other media might be. So are we more commercial? What is the state getting from that? And how do we address the content that is on NPR? And what is the appropriate role of state government to support that, Mr. Chair?
Ms. Radzak.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lilly, I appreciate the question, and you're kind of being open about a lot of thoughts there at once. It's a good and fair question. With regard to, you asked a few things, and I want to try to answer all of them. So if I don't, please hold me to that. With regard to what the state benefit is in sponsoring some part of Minnesota Public Radio, the request here today, for example, is about the equipment needs in greater Minnesota communities. But for state dollars, we would not have this infrastructure that we currently have, which means folks in Thief River Falls have the same access to our services as you and I would right now if we turned on the radio. As someone who grew up in northern Minnesota, that's something to me that I very much appreciate. That's what we get as a state. We make sure that everybody in the state, no matter where you are, has access to the emergency alert services, the Amber Alert services, and the programming. The more commercial, with regard to your question and Senator Goodwin's question, the way the underwriting, I'm not an expert in this, as has been evidenced by the earlier question, I do know that the restrictions on our underwriting are very different than what is allowed on commercial radio stations. A lot of the spots that you hear are still, if they have changed, are still very, very different than the spots you're going to hear on commercial radio stations. What we are limited in saying and how long we can say things that still is alive and well, and there is a significant limitation on what we choose to cover. I think that's an excellent point. And one thing I can tell you is that our news director, Chris Worthington, who he wants to hear from all of us personally. He gives out his phone number and his name. And if you hear things that you think, especially as senators who care very much about this state, if you're listening to us and you hear things that don't seem fair to you or seem like we're missing part of the story, I promise you they want to hear that. And I know people have contacted him, and things have changed because of some insights that he otherwise did not have. And so please, if you listen to us, and thank you if you do, let us know if you hear those things. And as for more independent-minded than most, that's the same thing. If you have examples where you feel that there is some areas that could be improved, we'd like to hear about it. So thank you again for the question.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Radzik. It wasn't quite clear to me on your request. Does the $306,000 represent the 2% in terms of operations, or was that a capital request? Because you said it's basically for equipment for outstate stations.
Senator Chair Perry, Senator Olson, if I'm understanding the question, the $306,000 plus the $154,000 for the FCC upgrade requirement, in addition to our legacy fund appropriation, constitutes the less than 2% of state funds. So I think maybe I didn't understand your question here.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I wondered if any part of that, obviously the legacy funds aren't part of that, but the, for example, the $306,000, mm-hmm. is that a bonding request? I said capital, but is it a bonding request versus a general fund request?
I'm sorry,
any
thank you.
Any portion of that? You said that all three of those things constitute only 2%, including what you're getting from the legacy funding dollars.
Ms. Ranta.
Thank you.
You haven't identified how much that is within here, but maybe when you send over your budget, you will include that as a separate item as well.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, it is not a capital bonding request because of the municipal bonding requirements that make it very complicated for a radio station to do bonding. So the 460 in total, and maybe it was confusing how I laid it out, 460 is the general fund request.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask that you please provide us with kind of an overview of the cost, the advantage that we have, because we, let me try to put that question in my brain so that I can spell it out. If the state what the state is investing is only 2%, and how much we get from that investment is important to us, as you hear the questions. If we were to pay outside of NPR for that same, it's impossible really, I think, to put a cost to it, but I think that we are paying very little money for what we get in return. It's my view. And if we were to say we're going to take that investment out of NPR and we're going to do whatever it is that we need to do, I don't think we can replace all of the, you know, the value really of what you provide in terms of, you know, the programming. I personally have visited a lot of radio stations in very small towns in Minnesota where if it wasn't for the radio, I would have not been able to talk about, you know, the value of education to parents and understanding new policies about education for the last 4 years in Olivia and Worthington, very small towns. But could you tell us, you know, if we were to say these 2%, which is minimal, can we invest it someplace else and get the same kind of return? How can we explain this in simple terms? How much would it cost the state of Minnesota to do the work that you do if we were to give it to other sectors?
Ms. Radzak.
Chair Perry and Senator Torres Ray, I was wondering about that too, and I pressed our accounting department to just generally ballpark number. they nailed it down to sort of the cents, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but I do know for every dollar of state funding, that's legacy and general funding, that you all entrust in us, we bring in $30 in federal and private dollars. And then if you take out the private dollars, it's about $27. So for every $1 you invest in Minnesota Public Radio in either our infrastructure in Greater Minnesota or the projects we do with the legacy funds, it's about a, let's just say just private, it's a $27, so $1 to $27 ratio. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Redzi. Could you talk a little bit more about the legacy dollars? I know that over the years when we were working, Senator Cohen worked very hard on that, at least including the arts. At one point, I think public radio and public television were actually named in terms of the uses of those funds. But that was removed. And yet the language, when it came to distribution, public television and public radio were recipients of it. Can you tell me what the nature of the use of those dollars is that fits in with the vision and the requirements of the legacy aspect of the cultural legacy aspects of that particular amendment and funding possibility?
Ms. Ratte.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we are, I think, what you're saying, and others would agree, one of the best distributors of arts and cultural programming, historical programming in Minnesota. I think we absolutely provide a service in getting some of our fabulous artists in Minnesota's better known by people around the state. We also produce programming that is focuses on Minnesota arts and artists, Minnesota's history, and some programming about our cultural heritage as well. And so I believe we're both a producer and a distributor of all of the things that the legacy funds are, the Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund that voters voted for, what their vision was for this fund. So I believe that we do both production and distribution of programming.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much did you get from the legacy funds in the last biennium?
Ms. Radza.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, $2.65 million for the biennium.
And Mr. Chair, can I
Senator
follow
Goodwin.
Up on that? And what before that, before you got legacy funds, did you get from the state? How much did you get from the state?
Ms. Radza.
Senator Goodwin, Chair Perry, Senator Goodwin, we've received a general fund appropriation since 1987. That's varied through over the years, and so I don't know if you're asking about the biennium immediately prior, or because it's fluctuated very much depending on what the state's budget was doing. So I'm not sure the best way to get you the answer you're looking for there. But I can tell you that, Senator Goodwin, what we're doing with legacy funds is completely on the other end of the spectrum for what we're able to do with general funds. General funds is only for equipment in for our stations in Greater Minnesota. Legacy funds are for programming that focuses on Minnesota's art, history, and cultural heritage. So the two are completely separate needs, if you will.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up.
Senator Goodwin.
But if you didn't have money from the state, then you would use another pot of money from your funding. What I'm trying to find out with some people that are getting the legacy funds, and I don't mean to be a contradictory or nasty here, but it seems to me like, and I haven't been around here the last 4 years, like sometimes the legacy funds, different entities that used to get general fund dollars are still getting those general fund dollars and getting big hunks of legacy funds. And I guess I have concerned about that when we have this huge budget shortfall to deal with. So, you know, it's maybe time for some of those groups to come forward and say, well, we've got this much money that we can forego in this budget shortfall, rather than when they know the kind of needs that there are out there and the kind of cuts that we have to make. So that's my concern, and I'm not trying to be difficult for you or anything, but I really do want to know why some of these groups can't come forward and say we're willing to forego this this amount of money this year. So my question to you is, are you going forward with the same request to the legacy funds or a higher request than you got the last time you received funds?
Ms. Radzak.
Chair Perry, Senator Goodwin, the constitutional language, obviously, just like you all do, we take very seriously. These funds should be used to supplement, not supplant, traditional or previous sources of funding. And so what we're doing with legacy would not be possible but for legacy specifically. Very different use than with the general fund dollars for this the stations in greater Minnesota. And so if all of a sudden our legacy dollars were taken away, a lot of what we're doing would go away. Just like if our general fund dollars, a lot of what we're doing would go away. But they're two completely different things that would go away. And so I want to be sure to answer your question. Our request for this year, for 12 and 13 for legacy, is slightly higher than last biennium. Instead of 2.65, we're asking for 3.3. The reason why that is because in the first year of the last biennium, with our $2.65 million appropriation, we spent about $1 million in the first year and $1.65 million in the second year. And we want to continue with what we're doing and build on those things and expand on those things. And so that's why we're asking for $1.65 million and $1.65 million. And we can appreciate the situation you all are in, but I think recognizing that they're two very different purposes for which we use the funds.
I think we're going to end this right here. We're going to be talking budgets very soon. And this will come up again, and I thank you, because we really want to get the next two overviews in before our 2:30 adjournment here. So we're going to move on to the fourth item. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Chair.
The fourth item on the agenda is a presentation from the Minnesota Public TV. If we could have the folks come up. Please state your name. Names. Did you break the chair already, Bill? I'd grab another one.
Well, my name is Bill Sanford, and I manage Lakeland Public Television. Had a fun drive from Bemidji this morning.
I'll bet you did.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Strasinski, and here today representing the Minnesota Public Television Association. We won't be needing PowerPoint, anyhow, just so you know. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your past support. State support has been very important to all of our stations over a number of years. There are three handouts today which I think will answer a lot of the questions you have. The first handout is actually a brochure that talks about the location of the six public television stations, talks about our history a bit, taxpayer return on investment, and there's quite a bit of detail about legacy funding, too, and what we did and what was accomplished with that. That's one document. Another document, Mr. Chairman, is actually the specific answers to your questions, which I received by email, I think, late Thursday night, about some ideas about innovations and what have you. What's our mission statement? You should have that in your packet as well. And the third document is how does Minnesota compare with its neighboring states as far as general fund dollars for operating grants, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but that's a comparison about how we rate. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, public television frequencies were reserved by the federal government in the 1940s as the demand for commercial television licenses exploded. Congress specifically charged these public television stations with the responsibility to forever preserve an opportunity for all citizens to have access to non-commercial media in order to provide for a free exchange of ideas essential to our democracy. Today, public television in Minnesota is the legislature's access to the public. Public television's free for the customer or the consumer or the viewer over-the-air service serves as a complement to government transparency. Citizens should not have to buy high-speed internet service from XYZ Corporation in order to watch the legislative process at work. it's free to them over the air broadcast for public television. In the digital environment, our ability to bring more programming to the public has been greatly expanded. Significant change. This digital environment has enabled us to partner with many nonprofit community-based organizations so as to bring their message as well to a larger audience. One of the new channels we have is exclusively used as a safe haven children's and education channel. It's one of the five channels we have, exclusively for children and education. Another channel is the Minnesota channel, which focuses on making state government more transparent and accessible to the public. For example, we provide, in public television, gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Minnesota legislature, including all floor sessions and several committee hearings. Our other channels will be used to continue to educate the public on important matters, ranging from how to deal with the stress of losing your job to helping Minnesota National Guard families that have been deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Bosnia. We have special programs specifically on these subjects. And, of course, we'll continue to provide the great culture and public affairs programming that you have come to appreciate. Public television is viewed as a cradle-to-grave educator and a provider of quality program and interactive services to the public. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, here's some facts about public television in Minnesota. Public television is a trusted source of nonviolent, non-explicit educational, cultural, and public affairs programming. We reach over 4.6 million residents of the state over the air. They just simply have to turn their television set on. You have to have a digital converter box nowadays. And we reach all citizens over the air on our cable and satellite services. Each station in Minnesota is community-owned and operated. Public television also provides educational services to 275 school districts and 192,000 students. And in fact, much of our legacy, Senator Olson, on our legacy information there talks about the number of programs we put together as lesson plans with legacy dollars, specifically. All state grant funds are matched from a variety of sources, including the federal government, corporations, and foundations. And public television also serves more people more often than any cultural or education organization in Minnesota. 2 million people a week watch public television in Minnesota. Specifically on the budget, I think the request, the governor's recommendation is $1,303,000 per year, or $2,606,000 for the biennium. I think that's what it is. It's hard to get the details, although I did have some conversations with the Department of Administration. The matching grants process we use basically to get these grants is identified in Statute 129D. We support the governor's recommendation for public television. And please understand that we have experienced grant reductions for a decade. In fact, our grants last year were only half of what they were 10 years ago. All stations, however, have reinvented themselves, laid off staff where appropriate, and become more efficient, and they collaborate with each other on an unprecedented basis. Further erosion of our base government partnership support will have a direct impact on our ability to help you be true to your mission and to keep your actions transparent to the public. If you think about it, and from the taxpayer, a return on investment, what do you get? These operational grants are extremely important, the ones you have before this committee. They're essential to basic station operations, and they help us put programs on the air, pay for heat, lights, etc. All contributions are generated from our respective communities are matched with state funds with federal funds. From a business perspective, the dividends generated by this your investment actually includes free non-commercial television for all, free on-demand programs online, free educational material for all schools and teachers, free children's programs, and free public safety emergency communications, to name a few. To increase the efficiency of the state's investment in public television, grants received by each station are matched by funds from other sources. Your investment in public television by this committee brings a lot of money into Minnesota, which would otherwise go to some other state. In fact, last year, the state operating support for public television was $1,258,000. That generated or brought in more than at least a $6 million federal match. And the correct way to view the state's investment is for every $1 that's invested in public television, it generates a range from $5 to $14 in revenue from non-state sources. I'd say that's a pretty good return on the investment. In fact, we don't even get the state money until we raise money locally to match from the state's process. Some closing thoughts, if I can. Public television is really you. Our mission is basically the same as yours. We all want to have an informed public and develop good citizens. We continue to pledge to use state dollars wisely and continue to take current events, cultural events, and programs about our involvement, our history, and our heritage to a statewide audience. State government has a long history of working with business and public corporations like public television. You have provided, I expect you will continue to provide, incentives in the business community, private nonprofit sector, which will enable all of us to create and sustain non-governmental jobs and services. Your investment in our public television, public organizations is modest, but it's essential. Finally, as you make your decisions, we ask that you please remember that public television cannot meet its obligations alone, even though our station managers are masters at raising money. While the digital age is very expensive, the opportunities are enormous. We are neither competitors nor a threat to commercial broadcasters. They are our friends, and they are because we are their public television stations too, and we do things that they are not structured to do. But we continue to need your help to meet these new challenges. We've always been willing to be held accountable. We are transparent for our products and services, and will continue to provide measurable objectives. We can and do guarantee a very large return for each dollar you invest in public television.
Mr. Sanford.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Senator Perry sent a letter to public television asking questions that I'd like to address today. First question was, what is your mission, and how will you accomplish it? Public television in Minnesota is unique in that it's made up of six separate organizations, each with local boards and local independent control, serving the unique needs of different regions of the state. Because of this, each different organization has its own mission statement. That being said, we all share the same ideals, and that is using television and other support media for the public good. Some examples of these activities are providing lifelong educational opportunities, partnering with government and private organizations to inform citizens, producing public affairs programming where civil discussions can take place about the pressing issues of the time, and providing a safe educational learning environment for our kids. Public television in Minnesota strives to be a local voice for communities throughout the state, not just in the metro area. Again, this is facilitated by the fact that each regional public television station is independent and provides unique local programming meeting the needs of that specific area of the state. partnering with the state to inform citizens is another way public television is meeting its mission and serving Minnesotans. An example of this is the statewide Minnesota Channel, carried by all of Minnesota's public television stations. In addition to education and information programming produced locally, right here in Minnesota and throughout the Midwest, this channel delivers gavel-to-gavel House and Senate proceedings, which helps promote citizen engagement in the political process. Before this partnership between public television and the state, these proceedings were available in just a few areas of the state and only available via cable. Public television is also very interested in collaborating even more with the state to help state agencies be more efficient through statewide broadcast and delivery of timely staff training and emergency information. Public television and all of its infrastructure is a statewide asset that is owned by the citizens of Minnesota. This asset can be used to benefit citizens by the delivery of audio, video, and high bandwidth data, virtually reaching all Minnesotans simultaneously. Another question you had was, how does the agency contribute to the improvement of Minnesota? I think that's a great question. I think public television works hard at that. Having educated and informed citizens is the cornerstone to a prosperous society. Education has always been the cornerstone of public television. Whether it's providing an educational safe haven for our kids, helping them to learn to count and their ABCs, or by providing local news and public affairs, public television helps to elevate citizens through education. Not just traditional formal education, but educating them on current affairs in their local community, the state, the country, and the world, with programs like the News Hour, Frontline, Almanac, Your Legislators, and locally in north central Minnesota, we produce a nightly news program, Lakeland News at 10. Again, knowledge is power, and before citizens can become engaged in their communities and help solve pressing issues, they need to fully understand these issues. Public television helps make this happen. And efficiency, I think, is one of the big buzzwords nowadays, and I know that was one of the questions that you asked, Mr. Chair. That question was, what has changed about your organization to make it operate more efficiently? Through digital television and multicasting and the internet, public television has really transformed itself over the past several years. In the past, Minnesota public television stations have multiplied their channels and services they provide to Minnesota for little or no cost increases. Gone are the days of single-channel broadcast-only services. In addition, public television is working with more partners to help their other organizations, state agencies, and other nonprofits get their messages out to all of Minnesota. Let me talk briefly about our station, Lakeland Public Television, serving north central Minnesota, and how we've changed and become more efficient. In the past, like most broadcasters, Lakeland Public Television broadcasts only a single channel of programming. Now through multicasting, we deliver five unique 24/7 channels to our region. Our primary channel includes over 8 hours of educational children's program daily. Evenings on this channel, we broadcast not only the best of PBS primetime programming, but many locally and regionally produced programs, including Your Legislators, Almanac, Almanac at the Capitol, Lakeland Currents, that's our own public affairs talk show, Common Ground, a legacy-funded arts and culture program, and our own local nightly newscast, Lakeland News at 10. Our four other channels are our kids' channel, it's 24/7, Create, which is a how-to channel that is also 24/7. We have a channel called Lakeland Prime. It's a channel with no kids programming, so that there's always something intelligent for grown-up people, so you don't have to watch Sesame Street in the middle of the day. And a lot of people appreciate that channel. So, and in addition, we carry the Minnesota channel, as I mentioned earlier. So we're proud of all the work that we do. In addition to that, we have an extensive website. We stream all of our local programs on that website so citizens can watch at their convenience, and also when they're away. We've got snowbirds that watch our newscast that on a daily basis. So it's a service that we provide to those folks as well. The interesting thing about this is all this has been accomplished, and we've reduced our administration, our operations, and our engineering staff in doing that over when we were broadcasting just one channel. We've got less people in admin, less people in engineering, and less people in operations. We have grown some of our production staff because we're doing more programming now. The legacy funds have helped us produce some things. Another question is, what do you think can be changed to operate more efficiently? And we have some ideas along those lines. Public television feels strongly that we are in a great position to collaborate more closely with the state, state agencies, and educational institutions. This would better utilize public television's statewide resource for the public good. Examples of what might be possible would be to provide improved communications with state employees and offices around the state, or timely statewide training, or delivery of any kind of audio, video, or data simultaneously to every corner of the state. We're here, we're able to do that, and we want to work with the state and help you become more efficient as well. We stand ready to work with you on this. We talked about investments and what I think there were some questions about how that money is being leveraged. I want to talk a little bit about that. Public television is providing a great return on the state for a very modest investment compared to all of our neighboring states here in the Midwest. In Minnesota, state operating funding for public television amounts to 24 cents per citizen annually. These numbers kind of blew us away a little bit, and I think they will for you too. Substantially lower than any of our Midwest neighbors. Montana is the next lowest, investing $1.08 annually per capita. North Dakota is next, investing $1.71. Wisconsin and Iowa are next at $2.46 per capita. South Dakota is at $5.04, and that's a state agency. So the state pays the whole bill in South Dakota for public television, other than what they generate for membership money. Nebraska is at $5.44 per capita. So you can see 24 cents is a pretty good bargain in Minnesota for what you're getting. And then the last question, are there efficiencies in your agency that could be applied to other agencies? Minnesota's public television stations are experts in video production. Video productions are used for education and training in state agencies, and that use is growing. State government doesn't have to build more television studios or purchase expensive television production equipment. Public television stations are strategically located throughout the state, and they're interconnected to the state's fiber backbone system. Utilizing this technology, all public television stations in Minnesota are interconnected with each other. Developing messages and delivering them to the public is our expertise. Would it not make good sense for the state to explore using this to further its mission to deliver services to the public? I'd like to give you just a real quick overview about Lakeland, and then I'll wrap up. In addition to being a safe haven for our kids, we provide the area's only local television programming. That's throughout from basically Brainerd North. There's nobody else that's providing any kind of local television at all. We do a nightly newscast, Lakeland News at 10. That is the only local news that area has. We have quite a few people that work in that news. About a third of our staff actually work in our news in producing Lakeland News at 10. As families face more financial pressures, many are dropping cable and satellite TV and are relying on Lakeland Public Television's free over-the-air broadcasts for their link to the world for local news, public affairs, information, entertainment, and to help educate their kids. During the last election cycle, in a two-week period, we broadcast over 10 hours of hour-long televised debates highlighting races for state House and Senate seats throughout the region. We broadcast them on our main channel, and we did it in prime time, and we repeated these hour-long debates at other times as well. We also put them on our website to ensure that all citizens had the opportunity to see and hear the various candidates' positions on important issues, helping them to be more informed voters. If state operating funding for public television was eliminated or substantially reduced, local programming like Lakeland News at 10 and our kids' channel would be on the cutting block. It's also important to point out that our state funding brings federal matching dollars into the state of Minnesota. So any cuts from state funding are deeper than just those state dollars.
Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Well, if he's finished.
I'd be happy to be finished.
I didn't.
How's that for honesty?
Chair, I didn't mean to interrupt or bring that about, but your presentation of kind of showing a relationship triggered in me a request for another one. I'm not sure if I would think it could be done, but when you look at all of the hours of time that you do cover the legislature, and you've described different ways in which you've done that, whether it's through some of the campaigns and debates, but also the actual coverage, could you obtain a cost per hour of your television time, and then correlate that to the number of hours that are used in covering the legislature and the public, the process of lawmaking? And well, I would be interested in knowing how that compares, aligns with the state investment.
Well, interestingly, we did do some research, and I can just speak for our station. I had talked to the Duluth station, and we were talking back and forth, trying to figure out what our broadcast time was worth in that size market. And a commercial station, typically in a market the size of Duluth or maybe Bemidji-Brainerd, we serve about the same number of households as the Duluth station does. You're looking at, in the vicinity of around $1,200 an hour for broadcast time. If on a commercial station, if somebody was to buy infomercial kinds of things, when you look at the legislative session and multiply that by all the stations, and obviously Twin Cities Public Television, their broadcast time is worth a lot more money than ours. I think the state is getting a real bargain in carriage of the House and Senate proceedings and the local debates that we produce. And it's not only just the broadcast time. When we're talking about local debates that we're producing, there's a lot of staff involved in coordinating that and arranging people and producing the program as well as broadcasting it.
But Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson,
what I was looking at was not by station, but if you certainly you must, there must be an overall a cost to running public television in Minnesota.
Certainly.
And if that could, that total cost, if it were divided by the hours of program delivered, and then you would then have a cost per hour that would be a statewide average.
And we'd be happy to get that information.
And total the number of hours that are going out on the, you know, in terms of the legislature. It would be interesting relationship to. That may not be the only thing that would be, quote, worthy, or some people might question, worthy of investing in, but it would be interesting to see that correlation between what you do in getting the work of the legislature out as pertained to the overall the cost that you to do with that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we will get that information to you, Senator Olson.
Thank you.
I think the other equation you want, or another number, if I might be so bold as to suggest that we'll put together for you, is what's the cost per hour viewed by the citizens of Minnesota?
Sure.
Okay.
And you're going to find out they're getting quality public education programming for less than probably 2 cents per hour viewed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how many people we reach. But we'll get you that specific
that would be
information.
Too. Thank you.
Sure. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you,
and we look forward to seeing you again. I've asked Mr. Tilley and Ms. Jansen from the Ampeers to come back to be first on our agenda on Wednesday, and they graciously said they would, because I do know we have some pretty strong commitments here. So thank you very much for coming back on Wednesday, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What is their request for funding? I had never heard that number for this
from
MPTA.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the request for funding, I think in the budget, maybe Kevin's got a better handle. I don't have a complete detailed breakdown, but I was told by Lenora Madigan, for public television, it's $1,303,000 per year for our equipment and matching grants program. Most of it's matching grants. I think only a couple hundred thousand is equipment.
Per year?
Per year, or $2,606,000 for the biennium. That's half of what it was 10 years ago.
All right.
Thank you. The legacy funds,
legacy.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, last year we received about $6.3 million from legacy.
And your
Thank
request,
you very much.
Mr. Chair, Please. This year your request is what?
Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to present in Senator Ingebrigtsen's committee. Our legacy request is going to be approaching $10 million for the biennium.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members, on Wednesday we will consider the appointment of Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. We're going to also hear from a number of councils. We'll be sending you a calendar of that yet, but we will, I can tell you, kick off right away with our good friends at Ampeers for their report right when we start Wednesday at 1. Being there's no further business before the